Accession number 20671, Reel 6.
And this cottage, we were told, don't go near it. It's deliberately there as a temptation. But of course we did. And I think the side of somebody shouted to us that we were leaving and to come away. And I stepped off the path into the onto the soil and stood on a mine, an anti-personnel mine. Now, I don't know if you know the way these things work, but when you stand on them, they're like three prongs. And these prongs trigger off a little explosion, which lights a fuse, which goes down and explodes another explosion to lift and blow the mine up into the air. And I stood on it and I heard the click as the first thing went. And everybody threw themselves on the floor except me. And I stood there with my foot still on it. And the fuse didn't work.
Leo Rumley, end of Reel 5.
Yes. Well, eventually, there was a bit of to-ing and fro-ing inside Belgium, but we didn't stay a great length of time in Belgium because by then the British troops were massing on the Belgium-Dutch border, ready to push into Holland. And of course we're now getting on towards September and Operation Market Garden. And our function in Market Garden was to protect the left flank at Eindhoven. The American 101st Airborne were going to land in Eindhoven, and our job was to protect their left flank, which was the road from Antwerp to Eindhoven. And the troops, the German troops on the Scheldt estuary, were on that road. And we thought that they would make every attempt to deny the British troops the use of that road for supplies and equipment and fuel and everything else. So that's where we were deployed. I might tell you that earlier we had occasion to be with the American 101st Airborne in Normandy when we supplied them. And we had a liaison with the American 101st Airborne. And when they landed at Eindhoven and we were allocated to their left flank defence, we came under their command. And we were at a place called Bladel. And villages around Bladel, Nettesel, Hoogloon, was our main operating area. And the brief was to deny the Germans access to Eindhoven from that route, which we did. One or two incidents that took place there. One of our officers led a dash and captured Hoogloon in one afternoon and routed the Germans. And
where were you then?
Yeah.
Where were you placed then?
Well, we were based in and around Bladel. And Bladel, Nettesel and Hoogloon are all within the same area. I think they're all in control now from Bladel. But I wasn't personally involved in this incident, but one of our sergeants who'd gone into the church nave at Nettesel in order to brew up was just making the tea when a mortar exploded and blew the wall of the church nave out, and blew him across the room and killed him. And he was the only casualty we had in that area. But funnily enough, some of the lads have told me that they were moving up through Nettasal, and they came across these crossroads. And every time the vehicle tried to cross this crossroads, it had no sooner got across than a shell from an 88 hit the road just behind it. And they realised that there was a German 88 gun covering these crossroads from an observation point that they couldn't see. But after about two vehicles had gone across, they realised that the OP, the observation post for this gun, could only see our vehicles as they crossed his line of vision at the crossroads. And by the time he told the 88 to fire, and the gun was fired, the car was across. So they got every single vehicle across, and after each one, there was a shot fired to the road. But they sussed it. And this, again, is indicative of the Germans' inability to, what we'd say, make do. Mm. Oh, my goodness.
Another pause.
Yeah, can you just... And these sort of incidents took place fairly regularly during the war. Of all the three countries, Holland was the most miserable place. We're coming up to autumn and winter. Desolate, flat country. No trees. Dismal farm buildings. Even the small towns and places were miserable, silent, dingy places. Narrow roads, a lot of them unmade. Ditches everywhere. Water everywhere. Dikes and rivers. I couldn't believe my eyes once when I looked up from the road we were travelling down and up this embankment, and there's a ship on the top of it. Ships, barges sailing along, 20 feet higher up than where you were on the dikes. Yeah.
So what did you yourself see of Operation Market Garden?
Well, we were engaged in quite a few skirmishes, as I say, around Blaadl, quite a few, because they wouldn't give up. They persisted in trying to cut this road off, and we were as much determined as they were to make sure that it was kept open.
You stayed in the one position, did you?
No, we moved around, as I say. We were quite fluid, but still in the same area. And we met up with the American 101st Airborne, and as I say, we were operating under their command. I think they call this some derogatory name with Limey in it, but in a rather a bit like the Australians call us Pommies. It's a name of derision, yet it's friendly. You know what I mean? I think they respected us, and we respected them.
Well, you've both been through a lot by then.
That's right. Yes, and. Of course, I think it was about the fourth or fifth day, the American 82nd Airborne, who were at Nijmegen and were responsible for helping to capture the bridge at Nijmegen, the 101st went to Nijmegen and relieved them on the far side of the Nijmegen bridge. And they asked for us to join them because they had no transport and they had no armour.
So you'd seen the...
Oh yes, we'd watched all the airborne troops come over, yes.
Did you have any doubts that it would be successful?
Well, almost from the day we landed in Normandy, we never thought for an instant that the Germans could ever stop us. We were in such overwhelming force, and we got everything we needed. With all the food, all the ammunition, all the petrol we needed, we were short of nothing. Even although in Holland we were still bringing it all the way from from Normandy, there was never any shortages. Never. I mean, how much petrol they consumed, I can't imagine.
But, so you didn't expect?
No. No.
That to be a failure?
No. Everybody fully expected that once it got over the bridge at Nijmegen, that short run up to Arnhem would be quite easy. But it's only when you've actually been back to see that road that you realise the difficulties that they encountered.
Mm. So where were you? You went to?
We went with the 101st. They took over from the 82nd at Nijmegen. And we protected Nijmegen for about 3 or 4 days. The 101st were then called back to England. And we were put back into the 53rd Div again. And I think the next battle from there was the huge set piece at St Hogenbosch, where the 53rd Div was involved in.
So where were you?
And of course we've learned since that the battle for St Hogenbosch again was involved in clearing the Germans from the Scheldt estuary to get the port of Antwerp open. That was the main consideration.
Yeah.
And
Where were you and what were you doing? What's my
witness? At St Hogenbosch. Well, surprisingly enough, the recce wasn't used a great deal at St Hogenbosch. We were in on the first day and we made a mad dash for the middle of St Hogenbosch. And we were only stopped, not by the Germans, but by our own troops. Because there were that many troops on the road, we couldn't get through. And by the time we did get through, it was evening, so we'd lost the sense of surprise, because by then the artillery barrage had preceded us and the element of surprise had gone. So we were then used more or less as a protective shield on the flanks of the operation for St Hogenbosch. We came in the day after the flamethrowers had set the buildings alight on the far side of the canal. And we traversed the whole length of that canal on the far side, little knowing that we shouldn't have been there because we were on the wrong side. But we'd come into St Hogenbosch on the old railway line, all along the railway line. And if anybody wants a seaside ride, they should try going in a tractor vehicle along a railway line, up and down the sleepers.
Were you sent in that way?
Yes, indeed, yes, yeah.
How many of you went? Was this
Well, I think all the anti-tank guns were there, so we had about 6 or 8 anti-tank guns there. Because, again, that's what they were short of, was the anti-tank guns.
So do you use your guns that day?
No, not in St Hogenbosch, no. No. Because I think the German armour by then had gone. They'd disappeared. It was basically a house-to-house infantry battle, more than anything else. The flamethrowers did a wonderful job. And as I say, my lasting impression of St Hogenbosch until I went back was rows and rows of burning buildings. And the fact that the buildings were on our right-hand side, and on the left-hand side was a canal, so you couldn't get away from the burning buildings very far, you would have been in the canal.
Did you see anything of the civilian population of St Hogenbosch?
Oh yes, yes, yes. In fact, when we stopped, somebody came and said that somebody was trapped on the first floor of a building, and the medical officer, whose name was Clark, they all called him Nobby Clark, he came to me and he said, come and give me a hand. So I said, where are we going? He said, there's a woman and children stuck on the first floor. And the ground floor of the buildings were all well alight. The whole street at ground level was alight. But he dashed in and we went up the stairs and there was a woman and 3 children in this bedroom. And I just picked 2 of the kids up and he took the woman and grabbed another kid and we all ran down the stairs and out the back. But he was quite impulsive like that, was the MO.
Why did he pick on you?
I was next to him, actually, when this person came up to him. Yeah. I think one of our lads had been burnt or something. He'd got a burn, and the doc had come along to have a look at it. So
what state were the civilian population in generally, and did they suffer as much as the...
Well, the Dutch population suffered far more than the French and the Belgians from starvation. They were very, very poorly fed, the Dutch people. But I will say that even on the remotest farm, in the middle of winter, when they'd virtually nothing except probably potato soup, they would insist on sharing it with you if you went to them. Always. Always.
Amazing. So after Setogenbosch, did you have to see any more action in Setogenbosch?
No. At the same time that Setogenbosch was liberated, we heard that Tilburg had been liberated, and that the road to the Scheldt estuary was open then, and that I think shortly afterwards, in that Setogenbosch was in October. And I think in late October, Antwerp was opened then for shipping. The Canadians cleared the Germans off the Scheldt estuary because they came up our left flank all the time, you know, the Canadians. So, and then the next battle was the Reichswald Forest. And I didn't know, but when I'd been back to Nijmegen, you can actually look across and see the Reichswald Forest. I thought it was well inside Germany, but it isn't. It's only just over the German border. And I don't know if anybody's mentioned this Reichswald Forest to you before, have they? But,
what did you know about it before you went there? Did you know?
Nothing.
Did they brief you?
No.
Or
no.
So what way were you getting your orders? Well, they weren't obviously explaining their strategy.
Well,
what would they just say?
As I said before, every night and every morning you stand to wherever you are, and if you've got a slit trench you get in it. If you've not, you know, you man whatever gun you're on and so on, so you know, a situation of readiness. And after stand to there'd be breakfast, and then the various sergeants and group commanders and so on would have a conference and receive orders from regimental headquarters, who presumably got them from divisional headquarters and so on. And it came down to, you know, we're going to take this road and we're going there, and then we're going to do this and turn there, because it was all fluid, it was all movement, you see. I mean, there was very little in the way of set static battles. I mean, Setogenbosch lasted 5 days, but that was only because it was all house to house fighting, really. But that was about the only set battle that we had. The rest of the time it was dashing here and dashing there, and probing here and probing there. Mm-hmm. And I remember the Reichswald Forest, when we first approached it, it looked all peaceful and calm, if a little surreal. Tall pine trees in early autumn time, and mist and damp, and we soon discovered that the ground was that boggy and soft. You only had to get off the road and you never get back on again. And we saw Churchill tanks up to their turrets in mud, and jeeps coming off the road and disappearing. We passed the driver of a jeep, stood on the roof of his jeep. The jeep was sinking underneath him. The road, the bogs, it was terrible. And once we got into the woods, the visibility was about 2 feet. And you were pushing your way through young pine trees. And they were planted so close together, and you couldn't dig in. When they started shelling and mortaring, There was nowhere to go. All you could do was, if you could get, I think the Germans were growing the trees commercially. And so, of course, there was always a constant program, presumably, of cutting. So you were lucky every now and then you would find piles of cut timber. And that was the only protection you could get. Every vehicle you saw after that, you know, was loaded up with as many of these they could fasten to the vehicle, because that would be their shelter. Rather than dig in, you would build logs to shelter behind, which was the only protection you could find. And this went on for almost a month.
Yeah. So each day you were going forward. And
yep. Working. Yeah. Yeah. Our job every morning was to go through the infantry who were holding the front and probe until we met the enemy, because you didn't know during the night how far back he'd pulled. He was in constant retreat, you'll appreciate, all the way from Normandy. He was constantly retreating. The only point at issue at any time was how fast and how far he was going to go before he decided to stop, and so on. So our job was to probe until we found out where he'd stopped and what defences he'd put up, and so on.
Through the Reichsbahn. Yes,
he didn't go very far in the morning to find out how far the Germans were, because they're only a few hundred yards up the road from where you were, doing exactly the same as you, building wooden barricades, and so on. But eventually we cleared them out, and we got into Germany for the first time. Yeah, at
how
Gok.
Did that feel?
Oh, it felt quite good, actually. Yeah. But of course we weren't finished with Holland by then, because, as you know, the Dutch-German border meanders quite a bit.
Did you see action at Gok?
No, by the time we got out at Gok, the infantry were already in. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. You see, the front, if you can call it such, was very fluid. It would change all during the day. And of course, at night time, you never knew what the following morning was going to be. Yeah. Because we didn't know what the orders the Germans had got as to where to move to. So
after the Reichsfeld?
Well, we were in and out of Holland, and the next notable occasion was when we got ambushed and trapped in Holland. And I have personal vivid memories of this occasion. It's a little village called Overdinkel. And it's 1 mile from the German border, and it's near to Lasse and Enschede. And we set off in the morning from Gronau, which is in Germany, to push towards Lasse, which is a straight road from Gronau to Lasse. And in the meantime, it crosses from Germany back into Holland. And on the way there, I don't know for what reason, but the officer decided he must have got some radio communication, because we did a detour and we turned left instead of going straight on. And so we came into Overdinkel at 90 degrees from where we should have come into it. In other words, we came up to this crossroad and we should have been coming from our right, but we came up. And as the lead car approached the crossroads, they spotted a German static 88 pointing down towards Gronau, where we should have come from. The lead car overran the position. The German crew scattered and fled. The lead car went over the crossroads and was in the process of turning round when it was hit by another 88, which was hidden in this little copse further up the crossroad. The crew got out, ran back across the crossroads, and all the vehicles then turned round to retreat back from where they'd come. And I was about the seventh or eighth vehicle back with the six-pounder, and we'd stopped outside I suppose they call them farms, but it's like a small holding, just off the road. I'll give you the situation. There's the road and a dike, and a bridge across the dike, the opposite side of the road, and a little farmhouse and a barn and a cellar in the farmhouse. And going further on past this small holding towards the village, there was an open ground. And then, running parallel to the farmhouse, at right angles to the road that we're on, was a street of houses. And at the end of that street was a school. This is all in hindsight, we didn't know at the time, but in the school were the Germans in strength. Now, of course, it only took them a few minutes to recover from the gun, you know, being scattered. And next to the gun is the church. And in the steeple of the church, they had an OP and a sniper. We ran our 6-pounder gun into the farm yard. At least, call it a farm. And pointed it towards the open ground and the row of houses, which was straight in front of us then. And we came under fire from this row of houses. You remember me telling you about Joe Porter? He was the dispatch rider, and he was behind the lead car. So he did a smart about turn. And as he did, somebody from the tower shot his bike, and his bike stopped, so he threw it in the ditch and ran back towards where we were. He got to this row of houses, and he ran up the back of these houses. And in one of the back gardens, there was a shed. And so Joe stopped for a woodbine. He went in this shed, and he sat on the floor, and he's having a woodbine. And the shed door burst open, and two Germans came in. Took his gun off him, took all his cigarettes off him, and all three are sat in this shed, you see. In the meantime, the sniper in the church tower was taking pot shots at everything that moved on the road, because he could see them, but we couldn't see him. And we were in the ditch at the side of the road, and we had two what we call soft vehicles, Bedford 1500 weights. One was the water wagon, which had a big tank of water on the back, and the other one was the ration vehicle with all our food and ammunition and stuff on. And both these Bedfords was parked, one behind each other. And each of them, the sniper, took out three of the tyres. He couldn't see the fourth one, you see. And then put a hole neatly through the driver's windscreen. And he knew that the vehicles were right-hand drive, but he didn't put one through the left-hand side, he only put one through the right-hand side. But of course there was nobody in them. But the driver of the vehicle was stood in the ditch next to me, and he suddenly let out such a yelp, and the sniper had shot him right across the buttocks, both cheeks, and the blood was pouring down his leg. He thought he'd been killed. But anyway, on my Bren carrier, we had acquired, I don't know if you know, a Bren gun has a magazine on the top, but for anti-aircraft purposes you can have what they call a drum magazine, which holds about 150 rounds, and you wind it up like a big clock, you know. And we'd got one of these Bren guns. So the sergeant said to me, get upstairs in the bedroom and cover that open ground and those houses. Anything that moves, let them have it. So I go upstairs into this back bedroom, and sitting up in the bed is an old lady, and I can still see her now. She's got a white knitted hat on and a shawl and a nightdress, and she sat up in the bed there, little old lady. And I go to the window, smash all the glass out of the window, put the Bren gun on the window ledge, and I'm firing out through the window there, And of course, all the empty shell cases, they come flying all over the floor. They make a lovely tinkling noise, you know, because they're all copper. They,